Afternoon, everybody. We'll start with our first case this afternoon is case number 54128, Physicians Insurance Company versus Williams. As you can see, Justice Cherry is on this panel, and I think the clerk is giving a disclosure. He was ill this morning, but he prepared for the case, and he will listen to the oral arguments and participate in the decision. So, Mr. Polzenberger, if you'd like to proceed on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you, Justice Gibbons. May it please the court. Dan Polzenberger for the appellant, PIC. If it pleases the court, I'd like to start with a discussion of the type of insurance coverage we have here. Because while the plaintiff's brief says it's a unique type of policy, it isn't really that unique. Certainly not even uncommon. Claims-made insurance is the type of insurance that professionals often have. I've been covered under three claims-made policies under the last 25 years, and it's so common that NRS Chapter 690B makes reference to it in the context of medical insurance.
So if you want to extend it, you have to buy tail coverage?
Then? Exactly right. And I'm glad you used the phrase tail coverage. It's extended reporting, and I can never remember the whole phrase, but that's what it is. If you have a policy, and Dr. Amati here had a policy from April 13th, 1998 up through 2004. And what the policy provides is that it will cover a liability under three conditions, that the healthcare incident occurred within the policy period. This is in the policy under Section C, coverage agreement, that it arose from professional activity performed by you, and three, that it resulted in a claim that is first received by the insured and reported to the insurer during the policy period. So that's the essence of a claims-made policy, that the patient has to make a claim to the insured doctor, and the doctor passed that along to the insurance company, all within the policy period. Now, there is absent a tail policy, and Dr. Amati did have the opportunity to purchase a tail policy in this case, and that's in the April 2nd letter, mm-hmm. where he could provide an unlimited tail policy, an indefinite period to report claims at the cost of merely $2,800. And he didn't do that. He didn't even renew his policy for a six-week period at a cost of $199. Dr. Amati simply disappeared. So this policy, though, provides two other opportunities, two other ways to make a claim. And they're very reasonable provision. One says a claim is made when the doctor reports a medical incident to the insurance company that is reasonably foreseeable, reasonably likely to result in a demand for damages. That way, and I have the same thing in my policy, if I realize that I've done something and I want to put my insurance company on alert so and not wait for a claim from my client, I can do that and have it covered. The third provision is what we have at issue here, and that is that there can be a report from someone other than the insured to the insurance company of a medical health care incident that is reasonably likely to result in a demand for damages. And I submit that under those terms, you have to provide certain information to a reasonable degree. You have to describe the incident, the identity, and the injury, because only then can an insurance company actually know what is involved here. It has to open a claims file. You know, in their brief, they talk about the duty of an insurance company to investigate, and they cite the Administrative Code 686A, 670, and that's the old regulation N9. And that says that when somebody puts you on notice of a claim, you have a duty to investigate. And in fact, if you go to the next section after the one they cite, you have a duty to report back to the claimant. Now, to whom does PIC report in this case? Because there was no identity revealed. While we may be a little flexible sometime on what the incident is, or maybe on what the injury is, we do have to know who the identity is. And we didn't have it here. A brief review of the facts. This is a case where Dr. Amati in late 2002 was arrested for drug trafficking in California and Nevada. There was a fax that was sent to PIC from an investigation firm that we had retained to look into a suspicious property damage claim that he had, a claim of burglary and missing equipment. And they faxed along to us a bit of information, and Judge Herndon said three things put us on notice of a claim, and that was a newspaper article from the Review Journal that said he was arrested for drug possession, a newspaper article from the Las Vegas Sun that said he was arrested for drug trafficking in the same event in California, where he claimed that the reason he had 57 grams of cocaine in little individual baggies is because 1 ounce, one half of that, was for his personal use, and the other, he said, well, he uses that in his dental practice. The same paragraph of that newspaper article went on to say how the highway patrol officers didn't believe him because it was individually packaged. It looks like it was for resale. A few paragraphs further on, it talked about him in possession of $6,000 in cash and drug paraphernalia. But Judge Herndon concluded the third thing was also that we had received, before the policy expired, notice that Dr. Amati had agreed to suspend his practice of dentistry. Judge Herndon thought that that was enough there for us to somehow anticipate that there might be a claim in the future.
Now, is there any law in this newspaper article thing that you've come across in your research and all this giving notice to the insurance company?
We cited one case that had to do with newspaper articles. We've cited a few cases that had to do with letters about general misconduct. And they all reach essentially the same conclusion that Judge J. Charles Thompson reached in this case, is that the general allegation, and I suspect here that it's really a rumor as opposed to an allegation, but the general allegation of misconduct is not enough to be a claim under a policy, or the report, I would say, of an incident reasonably likely to result in a demand for damages, because it doesn't say who the person is who's going to be the claimant. We can't open a claims file. We don't have that type of information. It simply isn't enough here to be a claim. Judge Thompson used the example of the endoscopy clinics, where there was the allegation that the clinics were reusing scopes and reusing syringes. But until the six incidents occurred that the CDC and the health district detected, where we knew that there was the allegation of hepatitis C being spread, and we knew who the people were, there couldn't be a claim. Again, I say it is incident. An incident is defined in this policy as any act or omission in the treatment of any one person. It is incident, it is identity, and it is injury. Without the identity, and without knowing exactly what a circumstance is involved here, we can't have an individualized claim. Now, Judge Herndon said, well, when it says any one person, and the policy does say that, that incident is any one person, when it's any one person, all it means is it could be as few as one. It doesn't have to be 50 or 100. Well, that ignores, you know, Judge Herndon is a very good judge, and they make a lot in their answering brief about what an excellent judge he is, but that entire concept ignores insurance realities. This is a policy that provides coverage of $1 million per incident with a cap of $3 million per policy year. If you're going to define incident as all the possible incidents, not limited to one patient, you get rid of the entire notion of an individual claim versus multiple claims. The mere suspicion that there could be claims in the plural, without knowing who's going to make the claims, without knowing exactly what it is that they're going to contend, is not enough here for there to be insurance coverage.
Why didn't Judge Thompson's original ruling end the matter?
What Judge Thompson did is he allowed it to go forward for more discovery. And they say at the point that that was in front of Judge Thompson, we had not yet produced the claims information, the log notes, or even our underwriting information. Now, as we say,
the order granting PIC Wisconsin's motion for summary judgment, I can't read the signature line on it, but there was one in a different case number.
There was another case. They tried to bring us into the case against Dr. Amati himself.
Okay, why didn't that summary judgment stand and bar the claims in this second action?
Because we got out of that case basically on a ripeness issue, saying that they didn't have an ability to sue us because they hadn't obtained a judgment against Dr. Amati.
Okay.
And it,
so it was a Hall Gunny kind of.
Yes, we argue Gunny too a little bit further in this case. I think that one was an easy one. I don't want to make too much of it and say that.
So you're not arguing issue or.
Not arguing that had a collateral estoppel effect. But what I do need to note, however, is that we appealed Judge Herndon's determination on a declaratory relief action that a timely claim had been made. Although he made that determination adverse to us, he also said that he was ruling for us on the issue that they do not have standing to make a claim for the policy proceeds. And they haven't appealed on that. They haven't raised it in their brief. So really, we're not talking about whether we have to pay this. We're just talking about the single factual legal determination as to whether there is a claim timely made. Your Honor, I'd like to save the balance of my time.
Okay, you may do so. Mr. Wall, on behalf of the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor, mm-hmm. Justices. I have with me Todd Moody, who was also counsel, partner of mine, and was trial counsel in this case. Just to that last point, quickly, that Mr. Polsenberg made, the holding of the court, there is only one issue before this court right now, and that's whether or not there was a timely claim made. Other issues of standing have not been resolved finally, and that'll be an argument for another day in a different courtroom. With respect to the question of res judicata, there's clearly no res judicata effect from the first action because it was a standing and rightness issue, which was granted without prejudice because there wasn't a judgment. As soon as there was a judgment, we brought the action for declaratory relief. Clearly, that is not barred by collateral estoppel or claim preclusion type doctrines. As much as counsel would like the insurance contract to say what he says it says, it just doesn't say that. And that's what this case is about. It's about construction of a contract. That's an insurance contract, which is a contract which is, by definition, a contract of adhesion. The insurance company wrote that contract, and they are stuck with it. If you read that contract, our claim was clearly made in time. And Mr. Polsenberg said there are two other ways to make a claim after he went past the first one.
And you're relying on the Sun's newspaper account of this dentist's arrest, possession of cocaine, and the explanation he gave that he was using it in his practice as notice of claim?
I'm relying on all of that. I'm relying on the fact that they knew that the dental board had taken action, and that had they done any investigation into the fact of the removal of the license, they would have gotten the name and the identity of the person. But I'm mostly relying on the fact that the contract itself does not define what a report is from a third party. And as much as they like to read into the definition section something that is not there, it's simply not in the coverage section.
Well, if they had heard nothing from anyone, you would agree there was no claim.
Absolutely, but this is a claims made and reported policy, but it's different from most standard claims made and reported policies, because in most of them, it's exactly as Mr. Polsenberg said. A claim has to be made by the patient to the doctor, and the doctor has to report it in order to have coverage. But that's not what this policy has. This policy has coverage if, specifically under the coverage section of the policy, which is section C, if three things are met. First, it has to be begun after the retroactive date. It doesn't say any end date. After the retroactive date, it was. It has to arise from a professional health care services that were provided. It was. It arose out of that. And then we get to the third one, and that is the one that causes the problem. It says it has to be resulted in a claim that is first received by you and reported to us during the policy period pursuant to Section H2. If you read Section H2, Section H2 has policy reporting requirements for the insured only. It has no other reporting requirements. In fact, the contract is entirely silent with respect to reporting requirements for a claim that comes from someone else. So then we go to the definition section of the contract, and that definition section defines what is a claim. And the first thing under the claim is the receipt by you, you being the insured, Dr. Amati, of a demand for damages within the period. Dr. Amati, without question, got a demand during the period and didn't respond to it. The second one is your transmittal, you being the insured, Dr. Amati's transmittal to us of an oral or written report regarding that. And Dr. Amati never did that, and my client had no control over that. And then comes the third one. The receipt by us of an oral or written report from someone other than you. So that's the report. It's the only report that is required by this contract, and it is not defined anywhere else in the contract. What is a report? That's all that this is about. And Mr. Polsenberg says, well, it has to have identity, incident, identity, and injury. Otherwise, we don't know what to do with it.
Well, but the clause goes on. It says the receipt by us of an oral or written report from someone other than you regarding a professional health care incident that is reasonably likely to give rise to a demand for damages.
Exactly.
Make your case fit that last clause.
It fits that clause because they all they have to have, the contract only requires that they have information about an incident that is reasonably likely to give rise to the demand. The contract doesn't say that report has to show incident, identity, and injury. Nothing in the contract says that, and because it's coming from a third party, the insurer has no control over that, and neither does the claimant.
But it goes on to define professional health care incident as any act or omission in the furnishing of professional health care services to any one person. I'm struggling. I understand your point that this is an unconventional claims-made policy. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that this clause is arguably ambiguous, and therefore you would construe it against the insurer and in favor of the insured or the third party here. But I'm struggling with the idea that there was no report, even looking at the newspaper article in The Sun, that would say there had been an act or omission in connection with the provision of professional services. The man was stopped for possession of cocaine.
And that's what they focused on, Your Honor, that there must be an individual claim. But I am saying you cannot read into this contract any requirement of an individual claim, because that's a definition section which talks about you only have to have one person, or you have to have one person to have an actual claim. That's a definition of what the incident is. But in the section, the only section that we have that talks about what has to be reported, it doesn't say that. In fact, the note specifically right under that section says, a claim received by you, the insured, must be reported to us pursuant to Section H2. There's nothing in the contract that says what happens with a claim that they find out about. So this is what they do. They find out that there's a claim. They get so much information, 11/12ths of whatever they need to know, to be able to open up their file, as Mr. Polsenberg said they couldn't do. And they say, we better do something fast so that we won't have notice of a claim. We're not going to investigate. We're going to stick our heads in the sand. We're going to send, instead of renewing the policy, we're going to look for any way we can. The only investigation they do is to see whether or not they're on a terrorist list. Immediately send a letter to them the day after the renewal notice went out on the 13th to end the contract on the 14th, one day later. And all they're doing is saying, we know that there is potential liability and potential claims out there. We may not know every single detail of those things, but we're going to cut it off and hope that nobody can bring that claim in time. Meanwhile, my client, Mr. Williams, has already sent letters. He's already requested the information of the insurance company. He's getting no response. He's getting no help from anyone. And the second he finds out the identity, he makes his claim and he's told, we wrote the policy that way so that we would never have liability. And that's what's going on here. So the contract says it can be reported in this way. There's three different ways you can have a claim. Two of them require the reporting that Mr. Kulzenberg has talked about, but the third one does not. It's not in the contract. It says the receipt by us of an oral or written report from someone other than you regarding a professional healthcare incident that is reasonably likely to give rise to a demand for damages. Now, it does say healthcare incident. And if we read into that definition that a healthcare incident has to be one person, then you can find that there might not have been notice. But here, this is a claim that the insurance company recognized, which is different from a claim made to the patient who then patient sues the doctor reports it. This is a different way of doing it, and they had the information. They knew there was liability. And if there had been two or three or four people, then there should have been two or three or four potential liabilities. And each one of those would have been individually a claim. We don't have to decide right now whether or not there was a claim. What we have to decide right now is whether or not there was a report from someone else within the time period that put the insurance carrier on notice. Because that's what claims made and reported policies are all about. And that's what the premium was based on. They collected that premium.
Do you have any cases involving a claims made policy where notice was given in a newspaper as obliquely as occurred in this case?
We were not able to find a case that was exactly like this one. The doctor went off the map and nobody knows where he...
Is he disappeared?
He has no reason to defend. He's charged with criminal activity. He doesn't defend the action that is brought against him. He doesn't respond to discovery. We don't have a case like that.
Were you able to subpoena him for a deposition or anything?
We never got to that point.
Okay.
Because we ended up with the position that we're at through the motions for summary judgment and everything. But we did not, originally, in the reaction, we tried to get a hold of him. We tried to subpoena him. We tried to do everything we could, and he simply didn't respond. We got the default, and we took the default judgment. PIC did not participate in that action because they were dismissed out of the action because of the standing issue. So all of this comes down to, if you're going to have a contract that allows for coverage when there's a report from someone else and you don't define what a report is, Judge Herman was then able to look at all of the evidence that was presented and to determine that what they had was sufficient to be a report within the claims period. The most important thing, not just the newspaper articles. Mr. Paulsenberg said the police didn't believe the story. It doesn't matter whether they believed the story. The question at this point isn't proving the case. The question at this point is, was there a report? It's the only issue. Was there a report? Whether the police believed the report or didn't, they had this information. Their own investigators had the information. And rather than investigating as they were required to do under the statute, Administrative Code 686A.670.
Let's say your client had been arrested for drunk driving. Simple drunk driving. Would that be a report that in your mind gave rise to a claim?
No, because the simple drunk driving has nothing to do with his professional responsibility as a dentist. But what they had were two newspaper articles where the dentist said, I have this cocaine because I use it on my patients. And they had information that the Board of Dental Examiners had taken Mr. Amati's license, and had they done any kind of investigation...
So drunk driving and loss of dental license, would that have been enough?
Not if they didn't have something more, but they have more here. What they have is the license is taken, and if they had done any kind of investigation, which they had an obligation to do, because there was a claim under the contract, they had information from someone. That was a report. Then under the statute, they had an obligation to do investigation. They didn't do it. In fact, they did the opposite of that. If they'd done any investigation at all, they would have known Glenn Williams' name because he was the complainant at the matter before the dental board. Instead of doing that, they immediately send out a letter which says, we're going to give you till June 2nd because that's what the contract required because we have this information about you've got this problem. But if you don't pay, we're going to cut you off immediately. Knowing he wasn't going to pay, knowing that he was the situation that he was in, their total move was find out if he's on a terrorist list, see what reasons we can come up with to stop this policy before somebody can make a claim. And the only reason they want to stop the policy before somebody can make a claim is because they know someone is going to make a claim. And there is nothing in this insurance policy that says the report must include identity, incident, and injury. The part of the policy that Mr. Poulsenberg has read to require those things, number one, doesn't say that. But even if you could read it into that, it applies specifically and only to a report that is made from a doctor to the insurance company after a claim has been made against that doctor. That's the section H2 that doesn't apply to the only claim that we have. There's no doubt that there was a claim here. There's no doubt that that claim was made on time. It was made before the policy ended to Dr. Amati. Dr. Amati had an obligation to report it. So maybe Dr. Amati doesn't report it and then he loses his insurance coverage, but my client reported as soon as they could, and this policy has a provision in it which covers it. That provision specifically says, different from most policies I've seen, if we get a report from someone else, anyone else, of a potential claim, and the only thing that they can come back with there is, well, the potential claim because it's defined as with one person. We didn't know who that one person was. I submit to you that you don't have to read that definition into the undefined term report in paragraph 3, which defines our claim as one that was made on time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Poulsenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's a lot to clarify in that presentation. Let me address what plaintiffs brought up first about no final determination. Of course, there is a final determination that they do not have standing and they cannot sue us for the insurance coverage. If it weren't a final determination, it wouldn't be an appealable order. And they did not appeal from that. So when plaintiffs come in and say this is an issue for another courtroom, it's certainly not a courtroom in this building. Dr. Amati was arrested in Washington State on his way to Pakistan. So he is in custody. He can be deposed. He hasn't been deposed in this. I think I win this case on summary judgment. I think judgment can be entered on this issue as a matter of law for me. But if there are more factual issues that need to be developed, they can be developed. Counsel argues we don't have to decide whether there was a claim, just whether there was a report. No. That's the issue in this case, is whether there was a claim made within the policy. And I'm not really fighting over the word report. That gained them a lot of traction in front of Judge Herndon, where he says, I don't know what a report is under this policy. I don't think it's an uncommon word. And Justice Pickering points out that the second part of the sentence is what we're talking about, a report of an incident, which is defined as medical care to any one person, reasonably likely to result in a demand for damages. So the issue here is whatever information we received. Now, while I have a lot of trouble with the newspaper article being a report, let's assume for the sake of argument at the moment it can be. Let's say a newspaper article lists the six people who have hepatitis C in the endoscopy case. That would give me incident, and he says incident isn't involved in this question. Of course it is. It's right there in the third definition, report of an incident. That would give me incident, identity, and injury, all in that. And that is my simple legal argument that here, regardless of report, we don't have enough information to open a claims file. They're coming in again with M9, which for people who aren't as old as me is 687A of the administrative code in about the 600s, and saying we had a duty to investigate. The duty to investigate comes up when we have a notice of a claim, and that notice of a claim has to reasonably apprise us of the facts.
And Mr. Poulsenberg, I think Mr. Wall argued about this letter. It went to Dr. Armani from the insurance company.
He did say that they sent a letter to the insurance company, but they didn't send a letter to the insurance company until September 27th, 2002. and the policy was no longer
renewed. The letter from the insurance company to the doctor saying if you want to renew or buy tail coverage, was there any evidence developed that that's a form letter they send out on lapse there? Mr. Wallace said
we are obligated to provide. Here's what happened. We sent out, there's a letter, it's all over the record. We sent out a letter saying you can renew. Then when we sent a letter on April 2nd that said, we've been informed that your license has been suspended, so you don't qualify to have a policy. We'll let you renew the policy for another 6 weeks at a cost of $199, after which you can buy tail coverage. We're obligated both under 690B, NRS 690B, and under our policy to provide tail coverage.
Is the insurance company, and I'll give you a little more time
for your
questions. When the insurance company finds out that his license is suspended, is there some type of inquiry notice then for them to check into why was his license suspended because he isn't one of their insureds, or how does that work?
Well, inquiry notice is a different thing. Under Massey versus Litton, inquiry notice kicks in when you think that you have a claim against somebody else. And your limitations period or prescription period starts to run at the point you know you may have a claim. The insurance company, inquiry notice doesn't apply then. You have to have an actual notice of claim under the M9 regulation we're talking about. And realize too that notice of claim is from the insured. But this parade of horribles that we're
go ahead and take another minute to sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor. This parade of horribles we're hearing about, how we were trying to do something to destroy coverage, just does not apply here. Because we did, in that letter, that April 2nd letter, say to the insured that he could purchase tail coverage. Also, and that was on April 2nd, we sent him another letter in July and said, you haven't bought your tail coverage yet. If you make a payment of just $717, you can have your tail coverage. So even after the policy had lapsed, we were trying to get him to do that, and he didn't do that. So this whole thing about us doing these evil things doesn't really work in here. Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say that my malpractice carrier finds out that I don't calendar anything. I don't calendar statutes of limitations, notices of appeal, deadlines to oppose motions. Is that enough for them to say that there's a claim here? No, because they don't know what bad thing is going to happen, and they don't know who the potential claimant is. It's like the Semenza case. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. And we know both you and Mr. Waller are excellent in calendaring on our Supreme Court matters, so we appreciate that. Okay, we will take the matter under submission. Mr. Moody, I saw in the Clark County Bar you joined Hutchinson & Steffens. So congratulations on that. And we certainly enjoy outstanding attorneys arguing for the Supreme Court, and we appreciate the arguments today. So it'll be under submission. As I said, Justice Cherry will conference with him, and he'll listen to the arguments today and all, and then we'll have a decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.